This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Opening day 2007, strikeout roster lineup.
Opening day at Fenway Park is always a big deal, so it was no surprise that on April 10th, a couple of hours before the Red Sox would play the Seattle Mariners, there were already lots of reporters, photographers, and TV camera crews on the field. I asked one of the journalists, who identified himself as Keach, whether he felt that he and the other writers and photographers were competing with each other.
I don't think so. We are, you know, we're family. Japanese family, big family.
Big is right. On this particular opening day, more than half of the throng was Japanese. Keach represents Sports Nippon, a Japanese daily, and he was in Boston to write about Ichiro Suzuki, the Mariners' star outfielder. One of Keach's countrymen, Yoshi, who works for what he calls the Japanese equivalent of MajorLeagueBaseball.com, had his sights set on another Japanese player.
Everyone wants news about Daisuke, you know, which is so much important right now. But Daisuke is so friendly, you know, to Japanese media, because when he played high school, you know, so much media and fans, you know, chasing his pitching and also his high school life.
Daisuke, or Daisuke, last name Matsuzaka, is the pitcher who's under contract to the Red Sox for $52 million, the team having paid Mr. Matsuzaka's former employer, the Cebu Lions, $51 million for the opportunity to negotiate with the pitcher. On opening day at Fenway, there was much excitement about what would transpire the following evening when the $103 million man would face Seattle's Ichiro, who was the American League's Rookie of the Year and Most Valuable Player in 2001 and has won 6 gold gloves and led the league in hits 3 times.
Tomorrow, national hero against national hero. That's why. Arguably, Ichiro is top player in the world. So Daisuke will be top pitcher in the world. You know, that's why, you know, Japanese people, you know, so much attention right now. Yeah.
The Red Sox have responded to that attention in various ways, such as by providing tours of the ballpark in Japanese. At the souvenir store across the street from the ballpark, the attention has been constant and profitable thanks to the availability of a variety of Daisuke shirts.
The proof's in the pudding. When you do look up at the shirts, you see that we do have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different types of shirt. The closest person even coming to that would be 3 different types of shirts.
Robert Petillo has been selling Daisuke stuff to customers of various nationalities.
I mean, he's what they call, what is it, the treasure of Japan and stuff. You know, a lot of the guys come in here, you know, unfortunately, don't even know what nationality he is. But when it comes to tourists, I mean, they gobble it up. I mean, everybody is just scooping it up. I mean, I would say 80% of our sales is Asian.
2 weeks after Daisuke lost that first start at Fenway Park, a game in which Ichiro went 0-for-5, the enthusiasm of Japanese fans in Boston remains strong. Aaron Nauman, the community outreach coordinator at Showa Boston, an institute that serves visiting Japanese students studying English, says Daisuke mania has changed everything.
My phone didn't stop ringing all day today, if that's any indication. We felt like we were this hidden jewel for a long time, and now, you know, Boston's just gone Japanese culture crazy.
Evidence for this contention is everywhere in the city. Restaurants and bars have added Japanese food to their menus and posted signs in Japanese welcoming Daisuke to town. Still, according to Aaron Nauman, those most excited about the advent of the era of Daisuke in Boston may be the fans who used to cheer for him in Japan. When Daisuke faced Ichiro at Fenway Park, the pitcher appeared to be the favored Japanese player among the Japanese fans at Showa.
The first game was great because it was happening during the day. We actually pulled our students from class. There's only 34 of them, but they're the most energetic 34 students you've ever seen. They're university students. They've been in Boston since September, so they were really psyched. And I think they were a little bit feeling homesick, so this whole focus on Japanese culture, I think, has helped them.
That focus has also helped a specific, rather high-end branch of the tourism business to explode.
We estimated that there will be about 10,000 additional Japanese visitors coming to Boston and Cambridge because of the Daisuke Matsuzaka signing. And these will be visitors that will be buying tour packages.
That's Pat Mascarliatolo of the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. He's been impressed with how popular the packages being offered to Japanese baseball fans who want to visit Boston for a few days of baseball have proved to be.
What these packages involve at this point, obviously the airfare, the hotel, the 4 to 5 night stay, those packages were selling retail for $3,500. They had 300 packages to sell because they were able to package them up with the tickets, so they had 300 tickets. They sold out in less than 3 days. The demand is just off the charts. And if Fenway, if there were another 10,000, 15,000 seats in the ballpark, I'm sure that they would have had triple the number of packages to sell.
Of course, Japanese players have been succeeding as members of Major League Baseball teams for some time. Ichiro Suzuki is in his seventh season with the Mariners, who also pay catcher Kenji Joijima $6 million a year for his services. Hideki Matsui has a batting average of .297 over the past four seasons with the New York Yankees. The defending champion St. Louis Cardinals employ Sō Taguchi in their outfield. But the arrival of Daisuke Matsuzaka has unquestionably upped the ante. The extent to which the golden child, celebrity, and multimillionaire pitcher will help his current employer remain in first place in the American League East remains to be seen, but his arrival at Fenway Park has certainly changed the look, the feel, and the marketing strategies of baseball in Boston.
Best sausage, hot pizza, sushi here.
All seven rounds of the 2007 NFL Draft take place today and tomorrow in New York. Over the last couple of decades, the annual event has become an exhaustive television extravaganza featuring college blue chippers smiling, shaking hands with the commissioner, and, of course, saying all the right things. But that sort of show requires the presence of many top prospects in New York, to which University of Wisconsin offensive tackle Joe Thomas was unwilling to travel this weekend, lest he break a tradition he's observed for years, and that would be fishing with his dad. Joining me now on the line from their home in Wisconsin are Joe Thomas and his father, Eric. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having us on.
Joe, I want to start with you. Lots of predictions say that you will go in the top five. Getting drafted into the National Football League is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You can go fishing anytime with your dad. Are you sure you made the right choice?
Yeah, I'm definitely sure I made the right choice. I don't know how many Saturdays I'm going to be able to spend fishing with my dad coming up here because I know my schedule is going to be really busy. And, I think a lot of guys put too much into the NFL draft. I think they put too much weight on where they go and how high they go because, for me, I look at it as a transition between my college days and my NFL days. And I'm going to judge myself by how I do in the NFL, not where I'm drafted on the NFL draft.
Well, you sound like an extraordinarily sensible young man. Did the league try to convince you to travel to New York for this weekend's draft? And if so, what inducements did they offer?
Well, they tried to convince me to come. I got an email from the commissioner and a couple letters from some of the other people who work in the NFL. And I was very honored to be invited, but it still didn't change my stance on the whole NFL draft and the fishing with my father.
Eric, when it became clear that Joe would rather go fishing with you than go to New York and be a television star there, the NFL came up with a novel compromise. There will be a boat cam allowing viewers to check in with you guys as you fish Lake Michigan. How do you feel now that you're going to be part of the show?
Well, it's life is a compromise, and we really... We're looking forward to the opportunity to chase cohos out on Lake Michigan. It's something that happens in spring, and we're excited to have the NFL Network join us and get to see exactly what we do in springtime here in Wisconsin.
Well, but there must be some worry that your fishing secrets would be revealed to the world.
We'll take that chance.
I imagine that you and many others have known for a long time, Eric, that Joe would be a top NFL prospect, but could you have envisioned that on draft day 2007 you'd be fishing with him on television rather than watching him on television?
No, it was really kind of a novel approach to the situation. We've always gone fishing in spring. Earlier, it's the brown trout season, and now we're into the coho season, and we knew the draft was going to be in April, but it's difficult to look past where you are at the time. And last year at this time, Joe was coming off a knee surgery. You kind of have to plan what it is you know and hope that it'll work out.
Joe, the mock draft that I've got in front of me right now has you going to Arizona with the fifth pick, but the Cardinals are not a very good team, and I'm told the fishing stinks in the desert. Is there an NFL venue that would be perfect for you in terms of both a football and a fishing standpoint?
I think all the NFL cities, if you look at them, there may not be great fishing in Phoenix, but you can drive 3-4 hours and be in some really good fishing, and I think anywhere you go, you're going to find that. You can find some fishing. It may not be coho salmon. It may not be the fishing that I'm used to, but it's fishing nonetheless. But I do want to add that in Phoenix, they do have excellent hunting. So even if the fishing's not as good, I'm sure the hunting will be even better.
Hey, you know, there's a big pond in Central Park, and there's the East River. Did the NFL guys try to convince you that there might be something worth catching swimming there?
You know, they didn't go that route. They might have been more successful if they went that route.
Well, is there a plan for this tradition to go on once your professional career has begun?
Well, like I said, it's going to be a lot harder, but we're still going to try and do it. I'm sure every time I'm home, we'll try to make it out in the big lake once or twice.
Joe Thomas will fish Lake Michigan today with his dad, Eric. We'll soon know where Joe will be reeling in the big ones during the NFL season. Anyway, thanks to both of you for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I don't mean to preach a sermon, but if you've got a son, take him fishing, take him fishing. Be his buddy while he's young. Time goes by so swiftly. Don't blow it all again. Take him fishing. Take him fishing.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a semi-violent Punjabi game played by semi-nonviolent Californians. But first, 1 week ago today, 92,000 football fans attended a game at Tuscaloosa's Bryant-Denny Stadium to witness the University of Alabama's white team play the University of Alabama's crimson team. Joining me now on the line to talk about the spring football fever is Alabama radio host Paul Feinbaum. Mr. Feinbaum, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
We know how Alabamans feel about football, but 92,000 fans attending a spring game, and everybody knew it didn't count, right?
True, but as one of my friends from the north told me, apparently there were no tractor pulls going on in Alabama that day. You know, I think the real reason is quite simple. Alabama lost 7 games last year, and considering that, for those who don't know, a scrimmage means that Alabama's teams play each other. I think the fans simply wanted to see an Alabama team win, which hasn't happened very often.
And did the Crimson beat the White? I mean, I suppose that matters.
I'll be totally honest with you. I still don't know who won the game, because that's all anyone is talking about is the crowd.
Is there any way in which this spring game resembles an actual, November game?
No. A spring game is, you divide the teams up, your first team versus your second team. Therefore, the players all know each other. They all know the schemes. They're at the same practices every day. So it doesn't resemble anything other than maybe the kicker in a live situation. But the 92,000 did not go because they wanted to see a game. They all went to see the rock star coach, the new Elvis, and that is Nick Saban, who left Miami after a 6-10 year to come here for $4 million, the highest contract ever paid to a collegiate coach.
I like the fact that you mentioned the coach's salary. Did they raise any money at this game? Did they charge these 92,000 people for coming to see a practice game?
But here's the amazing thing. They did not. It was free admission, and I would love to see an analysis of who was really at the game. I think a lot of folks who probably have never been to a game, woke up and read that it was free. And by the way, I know this. Some of the people in the Northeast listening won't like this, but it was 72 degrees and crystal clear blue skies. And I think it's just, you know, people said, let's go down there, and you can get, you know, you can get something for nothing, and that's exactly what they got. I don't know how much they got, though.
Now, Paul, I know that what I'm about to ask may be construed as sacrilege there, but are Alabama fans just a little bit too excited about spring football and the new coach?
Yes. It's often been said in this part of the country that football is a religion and Saturday is the high holy day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Saturday proved that to be correct. Football is the most important thing in this state. And you can argue and parse that maybe a state with the history of Alabama would be wise to maybe put more emphasis on highways or education, but this is what they love, and fans get into it. There's also another school here, Auburn University, and they drew 30 or 40,000 for their A day. So it's not unheard of, and it really isn't a new thing.
All right. Now, you're a radio talk show host. How many calls have you gotten after the A day game screaming that Saban must go?
Well, a few from other schools, but the fans, Bill, are in love with this guy. Of course, he hasn't lost yet. But
well, yes, he has. He's 1-1.
Well, no, he was smart. he just walked around the field and participated not one bit. He didn't coach in the game. I have a feeling we'll be talking about this for a long time. I'm just sorry that I'm not young enough to go back to college and do a PhD dissertation on this one event.
Paul Feinbaum is the host of The Paul Feinbaum Show. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure. Everybody can.
This weekend in Union City, California, the Sikh Sports Association will hold its first annual sports tournament. There are 500,000 Sikhs in the United States, with 50,000 living in California alone. This weekend, along with Bay Area residents of all backgrounds, Sikhs will compete in field hockey, soccer, basketball, volleyball, wrestling, tennis, cricket, track and field, and one sport with which listeners may be less familiar. Only a Game's Karen Given recently traveled to Northern California, and she has this report.
About 30 miles southeast of San Francisco, 19-year-old Sabi Santar waits in Union City's Contempo Park. It's a heavily overcast day, and his team has decided to cancel practice. But he's still here, hoping someone will show up for a scrimmage, and happy to talk about his favorite sport, kabaddi. At least I think that's what it's called.
It's called kabaddi.
Kabaddi.
Yeah, kabaddi. There you go.
Okay.
It's K-A-B-A-D-D-I.
Shooting hoops and chatting on his cell phone, Sabi looks a lot like any other American teenager. He's not the type I expected to find playing a traditional Punjabi sport.
I was born in California, actually. I played basketball, football, run track, and then my uncle was like, you should join the sport, you know, you're talented, you know, you'll do good. And so I just joined it. I started loving the game.
Sabi has been playing kabaddi for 3 years now. He's going to school to become a radiologist, which makes his parents happy. But if Sabi has his way, he'll spend the next 15 years or so as a professional kabaddi player. In Manteca, a small community in the San Joaquin Valley south of Sacramento, seven guys are stripping down to their shorts and stretching before a very windy kabaddi practice. They throw a few shoes in a semicircle to signify out of bounds, but then they get a little confused about how large the semicircle should be.
Hey, how many feet are the 100?
I don't know.
I think like 40 or 50.
It's a good thing Amo Singh, a volunteer for kabaddi.org, is on hand. He tells the players where to place their shoes. Four guys, called stoppers, line up on the curved side of the semicircle and link arms, waiting for another player, called a raider, to cross over. The raider will try to tag one and only one of the stoppers and run back to his side of the boundary. The stopper will try, as you might expect, to stop the raid by any means possible. He'll tackle the raider, wrestle him, or attempt to throw him to the ground. Think Duck Duck Goose, but, well, semi-naked and much more violent. And as Amo explains, with a time limit.
He's got 30 seconds to touch one of these guys and come back.
Okay.
And they'll start a little bit more further up, and they'll move back, because they want to waste that time as much as they can. Because it's hard for him to keep an eye on all four players. So, you know, they'll be moving around. They'll try to curve around this way, and then he'll try to get in a position where you can see him better. And then they'll make noises. They'll throw some fakes. One guy might throw a dive to distract him, and another guy might jump on top of him. You'll see.
This is the Punjabi form of the game, sometimes called circle kabaddi. The sport got its name from the requirement that players hold their breath on the opponent's side of the field, often chanting kabaddi, kabaddi, kabaddi to prove they're not breathing. But in more recent years, that rule has been replaced with a 30-second time limit, which has been further reduced by some tournament organizers to 28 seconds.
No, stay put here. Watch it. Sorry, watch.
And yeah. That was probably about 15, 20 seconds. You still got 10 seconds to run back.
Yeah. Today, Amo says, the guys are trying to take it easy. They need to practice hard enough to get ready for the upcoming season, which runs from April through October. But not so hard that they'll get hurt. But it really doesn't look like they're being all that careful. In an especially intense raid, the stopper wraps his legs around the raider's neck in what's called the scissors hold and gets dragged across the grass 5 or 6 feet before releasing his grip. I wonder out loud if a raider is permitted to drag a stopper all the way back to his side of the field.
They do that sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, if they have to, they'll carry the guys. They'll have scissors on them, they'll pick them up, flip them on their back. They do whatever they can. They'll drag you. Like, these guys don't really want to get hurt too much out here in practice, but if somebody would grab their ankle and, you know, they really got a good grip on it, they'll try to kick out. If they can't kick out, they'll just try to drag them if they can. If they're heavier.
After about 45 minutes, the team has had enough. They're tired and bruised. They've been bickering for the last half hour, which I learn is not entirely uncommon. There are two brothers on this team and a bunch of cousins. Usually, 23-year-old Sonny Condola's father is on hand to act as coach and peacekeeper.
My dad's here. We're doing way a lot. We should be practicing more longer. We would have been sprinting more. We've been running backwards, frog jumps. We've been doing push up. He's been trying to get me ready for season and stuff. So he wakes me up 6 in the morning. It takes me running to like for like 8 o'clock. Then he's like, all right, go ahead and go to school.
So far, that dedication has paid off. Sonny is one of the better-known raiders in Northern California. For the past 3 years, he's been named the U.S. team that plays at the Kabaddi World Cup near Toronto. He's traveled to England, New York, Chicago, and Seattle to play, with his expenses paid by the teams that recruit him. But kabaddi is a tough sport, and injuries are common. Last year, Sonny tore his MCL. He's also messed up his ankles and needs to have surgery on his toes. On the kabaddi field, he's seen players with dislocated arms, fingers, and shoulders. Sonny's father might be the coach during practice, but he has another role during matches.
When we're in the tournaments and stuff, he's always praying. Like if I go raid, he makes sure he prays I don't get hurt. And my brother, if he tries to stop something, he prays that he don't get no hurt because there's a 50-50 chance that he might get hurt.
For those who play kabaddi, sports and religion seem to be linked. Practices are scheduled around visits to the temple. And when I request an interview with Surinder Singh, the vice chairman of the Sikh Sports Association, he asks me to meet him at Gurdwara Sahib Fremont, one of the largest Sikh temples in the world.
Should I let me take you inside?
Yes.
First of all, one thing which we do is we cover our heads, so you will cover your head also.
Surinder meets me on the front steps at 10 on a Sunday morning. The Gurdwara has been open since 2, and members come and go as they please all day long. Just inside the doors, Surinder shows me a box of colorful scarves to be used by visitors. He picks out an embroidered dark yellow silk and makes sure I like the color before helping me tie it around my head.
So we will go inside, and we have our holy guru inside.
The temple is a peaceful place. Adults and children kneel on the ground while a priest sings hymns from the Sikh holy book. We kneel and listen, and from time to time, Surinder leans over and offers a translation. The oldest Gurdwara in the U.S. was built in Stockton, not far from here, almost 100 years ago. And Sikhs have been living in California since the 1800s. But Surinder says it's still important to keep traditions alive, like kabaddi.
Absolutely. See, the richness of the world is different communities, different languages, different sports, different colors, different cultures. So that is what makes this world beautiful. And kabaddi is one part of that game of a community, and it is critical that all of these things are encouraged and supported.
To me, the peacefulness of the temple and the tenets of Sikhism that Surrender has been talking about seem like a sharp contrast to the violence of Kabaddi, where almost anything goes when a raider and stopper are locked in battle. But Surrender disagrees.
No, it is not violent. I would say, violent is totally different where you would like to hurt somebody and so on and so forth. Kabaddi, actually, it just is a game which shows strength, just like wrestling. Wrestling, I don't consider it to be violent. It's much less violent than boxing.
The Sikh Sports Association's main concern isn't preserving sports like Kabaddi. Their main goal is to provide a bridge between immigrant parents who might be struggling and their Americanized children who might be spending too much time at home, watching TV or worse, being tempted by drugs or gangs.
U.S. is a big place. It could be an intimidating place. It could be a place where people may not be able to figure it out how things happen for many, many years. So what happens is the American kids, they're talking about games and their parents are taking to them to the leagues and the sports and so on and so forth. And the Indian, Punjabi, other Sikh kids, they feel, how come our parents are not doing that? It's not that they don't love their children. It's just that they do not know how to leverage the system, how to make use of the system.
Surrender says teams from non-Sikh communities will also be participating in the Sikh Sports Association's first annual games. And like the players I met in Manteca and Union City, Surrender hopes that more people from more cultures will try the sport of Kabaddi.
It's a game. Game has no bounds. Game has no constraints. Any person in the world would like to play any game should be able to play it. So is Kabaddi.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. On Monday, David Halberstam died in an automobile accident in Menlo Park, California. He was 73. I confess that I've sometimes been unable to regard basketball, baseball, and football with the solemnity and reverence that David Halberstam often felt they deserved. On the other hand, who could help but admire him enormously for writing about the war in Vietnam honestly and energetically enough so that President John Kennedy urged Halberstam's superiors at the New York Times to rein in their reporter? Some of the appreciations of David Halberstam have suggested that when he had finished a serious book, he would reward himself by taking on a sports-related project, sort of like the guy who sidles over to the dessert cart with a big grin after finishing all the vegetables on his plate. I don't think Mr. Halberstam would have acknowledged this modus operandi. The first time I met him, in 1985, I'd come to his hotel room to discuss The Amateurs, a book he'd written about oarsmen, some of whom had rowed for the U.S. in the Olympics. The Amateurs was an exceptional book for David Halberstam. It was short, but it was also fascinating, and it was, without any doubt, heartfelt. I saved what I thought might be my best question for last. You've written about war and presidents and world affairs, I said. You've won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting. Where would you say this book about rowers falls in the body of your work? David Halberstam looked me in the eye and said, "It's the best book I've ever written," which is how I learned that any writer's best book is the one currently in the stores. And then he smiled, which is how I learned how much Mr. Halberstam enjoyed passing on advice to a younger writer. Had he lived, David Halberstam next would have written a book about the 1958 NFL championship game between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts. It's a shame we'll not have that book. But in the shadow of this prolific and accomplished writer's untimely death, let us keep his achievements in perspective. The greater shame is that in these discouraging times, we no longer have among us the man who said at a journalism conference last year, "The crueler the war gets, the crueler the attacks get on anybody who doesn't salute or play the game." You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the tale of golf's founding father and founding son. But first, for a discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Monday, David Halberstam was killed in an automobile accident. Does it seem to you just a little ironic that so many people are celebrating the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who reported from Vietnam for his sports-related books?
He really did touch a lot of people in our little corner of the universe. And did so with the thoroughness and the intellect that he brought to everything. I, like everyone else, have a David Halberstam story, but mine goes back to 1974 when I was a junior, as you know, at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and our dean of our journalism school was a man named George Reedy, who used to work for Lyndon Johnson. And Halberstam wanted to interview Reedy as part of his avalanche of research for the book that became The Powers That Be.
Mm-hmm.
And Reedy blackmailed him. He wouldn't give him an interview unless David Halberstam gave the speech at our annual journalism banquet. So 1974 was also the year the Milwaukee Bucks were playing the Boston Celtics, and I was heavily invested in the Boston Celtics around town with money I didn't have. So I was rather on edge. And at the pre-party, when David Halberstam was surrounded by all these earnest journalism school people and some of them somewhat drone-like, asking him about Vietnam and civil rights and this and that, and I walked by, I had a Celtics button on my lapel, and I walked by to the kitchen to where the beer was located, and this arm came shooting out, chung, and grabbed my arm and said, "Who do you think they draft? I think that Steak'em kid from Providence is probably good." And we spent the next hour talking about the 1974 championship series, which was ongoing at the time, who the Celtics should draft, and about halfway through this, a bell went off in my head, and I said, "Damn, this guy really knows this stuff." And of course, since then, you know, this was prior to his ever having written a sports book of any kind. And, you know, David made himself quite willingly a part of this strange little world. I think the notion that people from government all the way to sports and sports journalism testified to how much he meant to them and how much he touched them is a measure of a life well lived.
As of August 1st, college coaches will no longer be allowed to use text messaging as a recruiting tool. They'll be crippled, I'm sure. Does this leave a large loophole for recruitment by means of fight song ringtones?
I have no idea. You talk. I mean, I've always said that college recruiting brigandage operates a lot like political campaign finances. No matter where you stop it in one place, it pops up in another. Text messaging is now banned. I presume somewhere, an NCAA investigator found a text message on a kid's BlackBerry that said, "The $100,000 is under the car we just parked in your driveway."
The Los Angeles Lakers, having dropped the first two games of their first-round playoff series with the Phoenix Suns, employed a different strategy in Game 3, and it worked. What'd they do?
Let the best players score the points. Let the best player take all the shots.
That was it.
Let the best player try to win it by himself. 95-89. I don't think it's going to mean anything in the long term. I mean, Phoenix isn't going to score 89 points in a game the rest of the playoffs, probably. It was a big win. It was a big home win for Kobe, but this series is pretty much over.
Charlie, as the NBA playoffs began, the league honored Sam Mitchell of the Toronto Raptors as the Coach of the Year. Do you suppose Doc Rivers was disappointed?
Now, be kind. This was a good win. I mean, Toronto won 47 games this year. That's the most they've ever won. He's got them into the playoffs. He got Chris Bosh, largely through Sam Mitchell's work and obviously Chris Bosh's own work, into become one of the league's premier players. This was a terrific honor for him and for a franchise that's often overlooked mostly by the people in its own country.
Golfer John Daly made a TV commercial, which, courtesy of CBS, we will never see. What's the problem?
Well, he's been, as you know, battling an alcohol problem his entire career. He made a spot for a brand of golf balls where he's singing in a bar with a whole bunch of people drinking what appears to be beer around him. CBS is up on its high horse now, grooving on the whole Imus thing. Max Fly, on the other hand, argued that it was only ginger ale in there anyway,
as
Dean Martin used to use apple juice, as we know on stage. But this is apparently not good enough for CBS. It really shouldn't be good enough for Daly either. He should know better.
I'll give you just a moment now to pull on your Mr. NASCAR cap.
In my case, it's overalls, but go ahead.
Very good. Now, tell me whether we should all feel good about Jeff Gordon driving a victory lap while waving a banner honoring the late Dale Earnhardt.
You know, we should, but neither one of us is a Jeff Gordon fan or a Dale Earnhardt fan. This is rather like the Yankees deciding to celebrate a world championship by carrying a Red Sox banner around Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium. And Jeff Gordon is the pretty boy whose daddy bought him a race car and didn't come up the old-fashioned way the way number three did. So Jeff Gordon waving a number three out his window, no matter if he did it burning incense and chanting Gregorian chant, is going to tick some people off.
We should mention, by the way, that the occasion for this event was Jeff Gordon tying one of Dale Earnhardt's most important NASCAR records.
Yeah, 76 wins, and I honestly think he was trying to honor the guy, but there's no appeasing some people.
I know you're a big Curt Schilling fan,
I am.
Charlie. And
I am.
This week, some question was raised about the red substance that appeared on Mr. Schilling's sock during Game 6, the American League Championship Series back in 2004. According to Baltimore Orioles play-by-play guy Gary Thorne, the substance may have been paint rather than blood. We have DNA testing to look forward to here.
Well, so I'm glad it didn't come to DNA testing or carbon-14 dating or something. since this is the let Charlie talk about his life edition of Only a Game. I met my wife, as you probably know, when we were both covering the Shroud of Turin Research Conference in New London, Connecticut in 1981. I know what happens if you say something irreverent about sacred pieces of cloth. They come and get you. And they're coming for Mirabelle and Thorne. I guarantee it.
David Beckham, eat your heart out, because a Croat soccer player is currently rejoicing in abundance. Any chance other leagues around the world use Zagora FC's model for compensating their best athletes?
No. No. Yeah, there's a soccer player from Croatia has scored 16 times this year, and he was unaware that his sponsor, who was happened to be a local shepherd, and you got to love any sports where you can refer to the owner as a local shepherd, had promised one sheep for every goal scored by a defender. The footballer in question is not real sure where he will keep his 16 sheep and counting, I might add, but I suspect his family's not going to starve for Easter dinner for the next few years.
And finally, Charlie, lots of people have run lots of marathons for charity, and good on them, but a fellow named Greg Billingham has apparently introduced a new wrinkle into that activity.
He's running in slow motion. He's taking one step every five or six seconds. Mm. And I guess he's doing this for charity, but he's also reenacting the climactic scenes and all the race scenes in Chariots of Fire. I wonder if he's got that tongue swinging back and forth.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Don't pay me in sheep.
If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. At the first open golf tournament, which occurred almost 150 years ago, the participants wore lumberjackets. They played their way around a 12-hole course three times. The prize to which they aspired was a belt that looked as if it should have been held aloft by a prize fighter. But perhaps the most shocking thing about that tournament is that Tom Morris didn't win it. Joining me now from the NPR Bureau in New York to explain that curious circumstance is Kevin Cook, the author of Tommy's Honor, the story of old Tom Morris and young Tom Morris, golf's founding father and son. Mr. Cook, welcome to Only a Game.
How are you? Glad to be here.
Very well, indeed. Thank you. Explain to me how one man, in this case old Tom Morris, can be identified as the founding father of golf.
Well, he was certainly the first true professional in the way that we think of golf professionals. He started as the greenkeeper of the great old course owned and run by the Royal and Ancient back in St. Andrews in Scotland. But he was the first really to make a living without being a ball maker, as previous gentlemen were, although he went into that as well. He's what we think of more as a club professional, a gentleman who will teach you lessons and handle things at the golf course. And then his son, young Tom, called Tommy, really became the first true touring professional.
Given the significance of old Tom Morris, poetic justice must have been dramatically absent during that first Open tournament at Prestwick.
Well, that's true. Tom was expected to win the tournament. He hit the first ball in the wind and had to correct for his balance, since, of course, that was Scottish weather. And the Scots say that when it's sunny and calm, that doesn't even count as weather. So they had a good deal of weather in those lumberjack outfits that they played in, which incidentally was because the local gentlemen were afraid that the professionals, who were mostly just caddies, happened to be the best golfers, but they were looked down upon a bit as caddies. They were going to dress so sloppily that it would do the game disservice. So the Grand Earl of Eglinton gave them some lumberjack jackets. They looked like a bunch of men walking over the hill looking for trees that weren't there.
And golf styles have just gone on from there, haven't they, down
the
years?
That's true. We did go through the similar checks in the 70s among the pros, but now the pros are some of the best-dressed guys in sports.
Young Tom Morris first entered the Open when he was 14 years old. Was there a special dispensation because he was the son of old Tom, or was young Tom really that good at 14?
There was not a special dispensation, although there was a little controversy. He really was that good. He was his dad was called the King of Clubs, and Tommy was the prince, but would soon surpass the king himself. Tommy did have, in his first great disappointment in golf, he went to try to play in a professional tournament at Carnoustie. He won there, but in a previous tournament at Perth, he wasn't allowed to play. Everyone said, who has ever heard of a 13-year-old golf professional? He went and played another young champion, beat the other young champion with a score that was actually better than the professional shot that very week. So men of inside golf knew that this youngster was quite a player. His father, old Tom's great rival, Willie Park, who's a great character in his own right, did look at Tom sidelong and say, what did you bring this young laddie here for in the first professional tournament young Tom came along for? And old Tom said, you'll know soon enough.
If a time machine were to transport Tiger Woods to Prestwick or St. Andrews during the 1860s, this time period we're talking about, would he recognize the game the Morrises and Willie Park were playing?
Well, that's a fun question. He certainly would. It might not have been the case much before the Morrises. This really was the original heyday of the game that we would recognize as golf. The equipment was entirely different. We had just gone from the feather ball, which was a leather pouch filled with boiled goose feathers, and then there was a great controversy over golf technology as it became a hard rubber ball called the gutty, the gutta-percha ball. Tiger would have recognized the way that the ball was moved around effectively. The terms birdie and par had not yet been invented, but the professionals knew a certain score they wanted to make. He would certainly have recognized, I think, a kindred spirit in Tommy Morris, who was the Tiger Woods of the 19th century.
Old Tom was a caddy and a greenskeeper, and he knew when to tip his cap and to whom to tip it. At least one story in Tommy's honor suggests that this was one quality he failed to pass on to young Tom.
That is true. Tommy was a much bolder character than old Tom. Old Tom really came from a previous generation in which subservience was a great virtue. Loyalty to both of them was important, but Tommy didn't get the subservience part of it at all. He was the first important golfer to play and not caddy also. The early golfers were all caddies, and this is, as you well know, a group of men who were notorious drinkers, gamblers, smokers, who were not very well thought of by the gentry. To some degree, their reputation was justified. There was one tournament where the gentlemen put up some money for the caddies to play for, and the first prize they got for them was a nice plump turkey. Second prize was a bottle of whiskey, and the two finalists were knocking putts back and forth over the last green trying to lose and finish second.
Get the whiskey rather than the turkey.
that's what they were after. Tommy was not a caddy. Unlike his father, who would throughout his career still caddy for gentlemen in what the gentlemen believed to be much more important than the Open Championship. They would play for the club, various clubs' medals. But Tommy was not willing to do that. He did not literally stoop to do that, since you would stoop, go down on one knee to set your gentleman's golf ball on a tee, not the kind of tee we think of, but a little mound of sand. And Tommy was not the kind of fellow to do that, and that did not sit very well with some of the very proper gentlemen of the RNA.
Young Tom, of course, didn't make it anywhere near 41, the expected lifespan of a man of his time. He died at 24 of a pulmonary embolism, although the more romantic among his contemporaries suggested that he died of a broken heart.
That is a long and oft-told story, that Tommy died of a broken heart, and he, I think, had a broken heart. He his wife died in childbirth when he was only 24. It was only 13 months after they were married. He had made a decision to accompany his father to a match against their great rivals, the Park Brothers over in Musselboro. Even though it was a short distance in those days, you know, to go 20 miles, you might change trains 7 times. You might take a ferry. You'd wind up in a horse-drawn coach. So that was a full day's travel, and he was that far away. He comes home. I don't want to give the entire tale away, but it is a heartbreaking story for Tommy. And Tommy, according to my research, did succumb to something much more ordinarily explicable than a broken heart, but I think he suffered from two things, and it is a sad ending for a great champion whose records really still exist. When they play the Open Championship at Carnoustie later this year, Tiger will be going for yet another British Open, but Tommy was the only one ever to win 4 straight Open Championships, and it might have been even more had they not called off one of them in the middle of that streak because he was so dominant they figured who wanted to take him on.
Kevin Cook is the author of Tommy's Honor, The Story of Old Tom Morris and Young Tom Morris, Golf's Founding Father and Son, published by Gotham Books. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Sure enjoyed it, Bill. Thanks.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Maggie Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Karen's Kabuddi photo gallery or my photos of Japan Day at Fenway, learn more about Tommy's Honor, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Sikh Sports Association Vice Chairman Surinder Singh.
You know, some people think golf is easy. No, golf is not easy. I played golf, by the way. You know, people get injured in golf.
Well, there you have it then. If I played golf, I'd drop it and take up Kabuddi. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at Mac.